the Pillars of Health podcast with strength coach John Carroll, coming to you from the Movement Lab in Raleigh, North Carolina. We're about to dive into everything you need to know when it comes to strength and conditioning, nutrition, sleep, and stress management. Check us out on MovementLabRally.com and CoachJohnCarroll.com. And now your host, John Carroll.
All right, guys, welcome to the Pillars of Health podcast. I'm delighted to have Nick Lamb on the podcast today. I feel like I've been trying to set this episode up for an eternity, and so I'm delighted to welcome him to the Pillars of Health. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. We've been at this for quite a few months now. I've had to reschedule a few times, and you've had to reschedule a few times, but glad to finally be on.
I know. Just back and forth, email tagging there for a while.
Exactly.
All right. So something I do on the podcast, and I'm sure you've kind of heard on previous episodes, just an icebreaker question. And, just like to throw a little curveball out there before we get into discussing you, what you do. But my question for you, Nick, is if you could go back in time and tell the teenage version of you one thing, what would that be?
There's a lot of ways you could go there for sure. There's a lot of advice. I'm sure there's a lot I would change. It's a bit cliche, but I would say probably to just slow down and enjoy the moment, you know, enjoy that phase of life that you're in. I think we're always so eager to jump to the next phase, the next thing, especially at that age. So, you know, just taking the time to, soak it all in and enjoy the process.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And it's so crazy because when we're growing up, we're so eager to be growing up, right? Whereas when you're growing up, you're like, oh man, those were the days.
Exactly. Yeah. Now how do I slow it down?
I know.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want all that responsibility. No one told me about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Well, let's do this. I'm going to have you kind of fill everyone in on what you do, your background, education, all, you know, the whole rigmarole, and just kind of let people get to know you a little bit.
Yeah, of course. So I'm originally a strength and conditioning coach by initial background, kind of went the traditional route, you know, studied kinesiology in college, came out, got a training certification, started training people in big box gyms, trying to train as many people as possible. Right. After a couple of years, I got more into working in the rehabilitative space. So as a trainer and strength and conditioning coach and with the rehabilitative population, mostly in like a post rehabilitative setting. So one of the things that really fascinated me in this regard was that I always tried to view things through the lens of health. So all the elements of health were always much more interesting to me. Not that the X's and O's of training weren't important, weren't interesting to me, but it was all these other facets of health and wellness, especially in the rehabilitative population. It was, you know, what are the things that predisposes someone, you know, more so to injury than everyone else? And that kind of led me down the path of studying things like heart rate variability that I was tracking a lot with clients, and it led to, you know, tracking, looking into stress management and nutrition. As the, you know, topic of today, sleep was one of those really big variables. And the more that I dug in, the more I just became fascinated by everything about sleep. And just the idea with sleep that we have this, you know, this is so many variables and so many facets of health and well-being. And then I think even more and kind of where I'm at now, I became fascinated with how little attention that sleep was getting, especially in the coaching realm, right? When we talk about, you know, how many coaches are coaching up, obviously, exercise and nutrition and, you know, really embracing that coaching process for that, right. You know, seeing how little that was actually getting with respect to sleep. And, you know, as we'll talk about today, I think a lot of the elements of improving sleep do require a large coaching element. So a large portion of what I'm doing now, in addition to sleep coaching for the general population, is sleep education for other coaches and other practitioners, right? How do you actually implement this into your process? How do you actually assess it and coach it up? And, you know, what are the things that you should be thinking about?
Right, 100%. And so, you know, it's one of those things, like you just said, everybody knows they need more sleep. But how do you actually go about creating that change? How do you go about implementing strategies to help someone achieve that? Because simply saying, like, oh, I need to go to bed earlier, you know, most of the time it's just not going to get the job done for someone, right? Because
exactly.
Come up, or, you know, life happens, right? So how do you kind of emphasize not only the importance, because I feel like the importance is lost on people because we've heard it so much already, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there needs to be more of a, just like anything else, I think there needs to be a little bit better of a construct of what we're actually looking at and how, you know, what you should actually be considering. You know, you kind of touched on it with the fact that most of the time, especially as coaches, we're just telling people that they need to sleep more. And that's never the process, right? We would never do that from an exercise standpoint. If someone just came in and, you know, said they wanted to start exercise, we wouldn't just hand them a list of things to do or just tell them to go exercise, right? We'd coach them through that process, and we have a thought process of the way we're looking at things. And I think there needs to be more of that for sleep. Because when you look at people who are actually struggling with sleep and have sleep issues, there's really very few practical options for them. Typically, they turn to sleeping pills, right? Especially when it's become a chronic issue.
Right.
And those sleeping pills come with serious health risks. And then the other thing is there's usually just a list of sleep hygiene online, right? The top 5 tips or the top 10 tips. And, you know, the problem with those hygiene lists is they're not specific to the person. There's no context, and, you know, the person doesn't know where to start. So, you know, what I've kind of done in my coaching process and what I'm trying to, you know, translate to everyone else is, you know, how do you assess, right? So how do you know where to start and what areas you should be focusing on? And then a hierarchy system of, you know, based on my experience, what are the big rocks and where should you try to attack first? Right. And then if that's not the main variable, where do you go from there? So it's just this hierarchy system of, you know, I have kind of 4 main pillars and we try to attack each of these pillars in order. And obviously before that, we're screening out and make sure we do a detailed medical history. And there's a lot of medical conditions that obviously can impact sleep that we want to make sure we screen out. But in the actual coaching process, it really comes down to these, you know, the structure of these pillars.
Right. So you have a structured approach to kind of basically progressing someone through where you want to get into, much like a strength and conditioning coach, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And now for people, again, listening who are like, okay, you know, again, everybody needs sleep and it's vitally important, but what exactly is happening in the body? What is happening in the brain while we're asleep to make it so vitally important?
Yeah, I think the biggest misconception that I think people have, and obviously they know that it's important, but there's the disconnect with exactly what you mentioned. They're not really understanding what actually occurs. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that, and the part of that disconnect is that people look at sleep as a time of solely rest. And it is that, right, to a certain degree. But I think it's the understanding that your brain and your body, every single system, every single physiological system of your body actually is incredibly active while you're sleeping from a restorative and rest standpoint. But right, every single system of your body, we haven't really been able to find one physiological system of your body that's not impacted by sleep, right? Either positively when you get it, right, enhancing that system, or negatively when you're not getting, right? So I think, you know, people have to look at it as you spend a third of your life sleeping, right? You're going to spend more time sleeping than any other one activity. So firstly, Mother Nature must have kept it around for that amount of time of our life to be really pivotally important. And if we're going to spend that much time doing something, we want to make sure it's most optimal, right? So yeah, so I mean the way I look at sleep is, you know, it's your ultimate life enhancer, right? It's this free life insurance policy that you have, this free natural performance enhancement drug, mm-hmm. That can influence so many other variables and so many other facets of not just your health, but your performance, both in life and work, and you know, the quality of your relationships. We all know that when we don't get good sleep, we're more on edge, right, with the people that we love. So, you know, really every facet of your life can be enhanced in some way when we just kind of embrace this thing called sleep.
Yeah. And you touched on it there. It is the number one performance enhancer around. Whereas, you know, it's crazy. I'll have high school kids. I'll have just people in general, and be like, "What can I do for this? You know, what can I do to improve my numbers in the weight room, or what can I do to improve to get stronger?" And it's like, listen, if you're lifting 2 or 3 times a week, if you're getting sufficient sleep, if you're eating real food, like hit those pillars, and you really can't go wrong from there. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and the nice thing with sleep, and I always tell people this, is like, you know, when you talk about trying to improve your performance and you try to talk about improving your body composition and all the things that, you know, that people are working towards, of all the things that you have to do in that process, sleep is the most pleasant, right? Getting a good, who doesn't want a good night's sleep? So it's this, you know, lever that you have to pull that's, you know, so foundational, and it's going to impact so many variables, but it's the most pleasant, right? I mean, so.
Exactly. Like who doesn't enjoy waking up after a restful sleep and, you know, having that energy to go about what you need to do for the rest of the day? Because like you said, when you don't get that full night's sleep, everything else becomes 10 times harder instantaneously.
Exactly. And I think, you know, whether, especially from the standpoint of a coach, and why I'm trying to bring this more into the coaching, you know, standpoint, is if you don't check this box, right, if you have the client that's either not sleeping enough or they're not getting the right quality of sleep, like you mentioned, every single aspect of what you're trying to do with that person is going to be more challenging, right? The behavior change is going to be more challenging. We know that it affects every aspect of physical performance and everything from your time to fatigue to your actual motor control to, you know, every single facet of what you're trying to do with someone. You're going to have a lot harder of a time with that, right? The nutritional aspect. We know that when you're sleep deprived, you increase the amount of calories that you're actually taking in that following day. You're making poorer decisions with those calories. What your body actually does with those calories changes when you're not getting sleep. So, you know, again, it's this linchpin. And if we don't check that box, you know, everything else is going to be more of an uphill battle.
For sure. Yeah. And, you know, just to kind of fill you in, a personal story of mine, some of the clients I have, you know, they are working night shifts and just shift work in general. And, you know, if they come in and they're telling me, you know, last night I got 4 hours sleep, you know, I'm instantaneously thinking, all right, I have to change today's programming to basically allow them to get through this to, you know, I'm not going to put them in the ground, so to speak. Not that I do that to anybody, but, you know, I'm not going to put a very, very challenging session on someone who's coming off 3 or 4 hours sleep.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could look at as the best and easiest to implement objective readiness measure, or I guess it would be more subjective, but the best readiness measure that you can have is, how did you sleep last night? And, you know, how rested are you feeling today? And that's, you know, that's going to unfortunately gauge a lot of what you're able to do with that person for that day, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And now, when it comes to the recommended number of hours per night, you know, we've heard this for like must be 50, 60 years, you know, 8 hours sleep a night. Where do you stand on that? What do you advise people on in relation to what's optimal?
Yeah. Yeah, I get to ask this all the time. And, you know, there's, of course, just like anything else in the industry, you know, it depends. And there's no one specific answer or recommendation for everyone. What I will say is that we definitely place entirely too much emphasis on the quantity over the quality of sleep. And part of this is obviously that it's tougher to quantify the quality of sleep. Sleep trackers have, you know, been introduced that play a role in this. We could talk more about them. However, I think the problem is that, you know, people are gauging their sleep health and their sleep success on how many hours that they're getting. And, you know, this is very misleading because it doesn't account for that quality aspect. And people tend to also not be very efficient sleepers. What I mean by that is, when we talk about sleep efficiency, you know, it's a real metric for sleep health that we're looking at in terms of what percentage of time are you actually asleep relative to your time in bed. So, you know, people are really poor at estimating this. And just because you're obviously in bed for 8 hours doesn't mean you slept 8 hours. And, you know, when we look at, so part of where this 7 to 9 hours came from, firstly, it came from some of the research that was done where we were looking at the correlations between sleep duration and lifespan. And there's this sweet spot between, you know, kind of 7 and 8 hours where we see the greatest lifespan in those people. And if you dip below that, we see a decrease in lifespan. And actually, if we go above that, right, if we're sleeping too much, we also see a dip in lifespan. And this is probably because these are people who are much more sick and they're sleeping a lot more. The other way that we got this was, if you take people and you detach them from modern society, if you take them out of their normal environment and you kind of just put them in normal environment, right? You put them out in nature, so to speak, and you allow them to sleep what they would prefer, people tend to fall around that block. So it tends to be physiologically what we crave is that amount. But it does vary person to person. A caveat that I always touch on is, you know, the Donald Trumps of the world and, you know, people in the corporate world that will claim that they can get by on 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And a lot of people will often be like, oh, that's me, I can get by. Right. And there's a difference between getting by and thriving. Mm-hmm. And there's a very, very, very small percentage of the population who is much more efficient in their sleep, and they actually can function on less sleep, right? Mm-hmm. They're much more efficient in their cycles of sleep in less amount of time. But we're talking like less than a percent, like a fraction of a percent. Right. So in most instances, you know, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, that's me, it's probably not, right? You just, more likely is that I think and I talk about this a lot with people, is we've set a new baseline and a new norm for ourselves based on what we're currently sleeping. And it doesn't mean that it's most optimal, but we've kind of forgotten what it's like to be at most optimal, right? Where we're most rested, where we don't need caffeine to function. So I think it's more about, you know, kind of resetting that baseline.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Totally agree. And yeah, I've always heard that, you know, I think initially when it first came out that like, there's a certain amount of the population that can survive, that can thrive on less sleep. And then all of a sudden you had people saying, yep, that's me. I was like, maybe not that many people.
it's a very, very small subset of the population. And, you know, even for those people, it doesn't mean that they can't get more sleep or that they wouldn't benefit from getting more sleep as well. It's, you know, kind of the figuring out what's optimal. So back, just quickly kind of wrapping up, but back to the, you know, quality versus quantity. And this comes from Dr. Matthew Walker, and anyone who's obviously interested in sleep, definitely read his book, Why We Sleep. Mm-hmm. It breaks a lot of things down, but he details out four pillars to what actually makes up healthy sleep. And I think it's important to understand that you need all four of them. And if you shortchange any of the four, you're not getting your most optimal sleep. So these four pillars are, firstly, quantity, right? Like we just talked about, we know that the actual duration of sleep does matter. Next is the quality or the depth. So if we were to have you in a sleep lab and we were to look at the electrical signature in the brain, right, what's actually happening in the brain waves, this is how we quantify, you know, the quality of sleep, right? Are you getting into those deeper stages of sleep and spending, you know, the prerequisite time that you need in those stages? The next pillar is regularity. So we can talk a little bit about circadian rhythms and circadian health and how important this is. This is why the regularity aspect is so important. And then the last is continuity. So the difference between continuity and regularity is more the consistency in terms of, you know, your sleep time, your wake time, the consistency of other things that you're doing. Whereas continuity, we're talking about continuous sleep throughout the night, where we do get awakenings after every sleep cycle, but we don't want interruptions into our sleep cycles. We don't want our sleep to be fragmented. If we take something like, for example, when you drink alcohol, we can see pretty clearly that alcohol fragments your sleep, where you get these mini awakenings, most of which you don't even realize. So anything that disrupts the continuity of your sleep. So again, you know, these are the four pillars and we need all of them in some way, shape or form. And if we shortchange any of them, we're going to be getting, you know, less than optimal sleep.
Right. Now, For people who are working with you, and even just for people listening, right, what are some of your like go-to actionable steps initially starting off with someone to help them, you know, kind of ensure their sleep hours are more restful moving forward?
Yeah, for sure. So again, I break this in terms of my sleep optimization, I break it into a system of hierarchy. Right. So the first pillar and the first and most important is the one that gets talked about the least, and that's the behavioral aspect of sleep, the behavioral nature to improving sleep. This is also, in my opinion, why coaching is so important, because these aspects are difficult to change and implement, but they're also going to be the most impactful. So not to say that you can't do these things or implement these things without a coach, but if these boxes of the behavioral aspect, just like anything else we do, aren't checked off, you're going to have a lot more of a hard time with, you know, you can't just make technology hacks or these type of things if the behavioral approach to your sleep is off, right? So firstly is your thoughts and your perceptions surrounding sleep and your sleep situation, because these are going to drive your emotions and your habits. So, you know, especially if you've been notoriously a bad sleeper for a period of time, right? You've always struggled with sleep, or you're in a cycle right now where you're struggling with sleep. You have to take an honest look and take a step back at what your thoughts and your perceptions are of that situation. Do you dramatize the situation, right? Where leading into sleep, you're like, oh my God, there's no way I'm going to sleep tonight. I never sleep. And because of that, you know, I'm going to have a miserable day at work tomorrow. And, you know, these type of thoughts obviously are going to drive the cycle further a lot forward. So, you know, what I do with people in this is, firstly, you have to just, again, make that honest assessment of what those thoughts are and what those perceptions are. And then we do something that's called cognitive restructuring. And this really is just a fancy way of saying we're trying to reframe those thoughts. Right. So when you actually write these thoughts out and see them, sometimes it's a lot easier to see, well, that's kind of ridiculous. Like that's probably a little dramatic, right? And we can rewrite it in a more positive light, and then just practice these things, right? So saying them out loud, actually like the positive affirmation of saying these things out loud makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Writing them and putting them somewhere that you're going to see them on a consistent basis, interjecting them into conversation with someone else. We're just trying to restructure those thoughts, because if we don't, we're going to get stuck in this cycle, and it's very difficult to break out of that cycle. And the longer that it sticks around, the harder it is.
Yeah. Now, for someone who's on that cycle and has been for a while, what are some of the side effects of maybe chronic sleep deprivation that they will see the further they get into that cycle?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, that you can, discuss. I think, like we were touched on earlier, I think when people are chronically sleep deprived, they've set a new baseline or a new norm for themselves in terms of how they've, you know, how they function, or they've forgotten what it feels like to be at normal. So, you know, there's really, it's a lot of subjective things that I'll track with people. So it's subjectively looking at, you know, your mood, your energy levels, you know, your performance, your ability to focus. When you start to see, you know, all of these things go in the opposite direction, you know, that's when you want to be, you know, thinking in terms of maybe I'm chronically sleep deprived. Obviously, bouts of sleepiness during the day, the need for caffeine, especially, and this is a common thing I see, if you look at the circadian rhythm of when we would be the most alert and when we would actually benefit from having caffeine, or when caffeine would be most beneficial, it's not immediately upon waking. It's actually a couple hours after we wake up. And so if you're the, you know, the person who wakes up and, you know, you immediately need that cup of coffee, and I know a lot of people like this, and I was actually that way for quite some time. You know, the first thing that you do sometimes even before you go to the bathroom is you're at your Keurig or you're at your Nespresso machine making coffee. Again, that's a sign that you're probably built up quite the, you know, chronic accumulation of what we call sleep debt.
Yeah, it's kind of manifested itself to become almost a popular thing. Like, oh, I got to get my coffee in the morning, you know, whereas it's crazy that you say that, because I feel 100 times better if I wait 2 or 3 hours until having coffee the first time.
Exactly. I mean, if you, again, with the circadian rhythm, in an ideal circadian rhythm, your cortisol levels are going to be highest mm-hmm. when you first wake up. So your cortisol levels should be what's waking you up and making you feel most alert in the first couple hours of the day. So that would be like the normal rise of energy. And then, you know, as that cortisol levels start to dip just a little bit after those mm-hmm. couple of hours, you know, that's when, you know, caffeine would be beneficial. And it's still early enough in the day that it's not going to impact your sleep later on. Right. And all of those things as well.
Yeah. And you touched on, you know, sleepiness during the day. Is there a place for naps in someone's routine?
There is. Naps are one of those things, especially for me as a coach, they're very difficult to make any kind of general recommendations because they're very case specific, very situation dependent. A couple points, though, that I'll make for anyone who's currently struggling with sleep, you know, with their overall sleep, especially if you're having issues falling asleep, I typically discourage those people from taking naps. And the reason for that is one of the principal mechanisms for how we initiate sleep and how we initiate good sleep is buildup of a chemical called adenosine. It's this sleep pressure. So for every second that you're awake, more of this sleep pressure builds up. And when we have a lot of this healthy sleep pressure, it really helps us to fall asleep faster and fall asleep deeper. And especially if you're having issues with falling asleep, like I mentioned, naps can deplete some of this healthy sleep pressure, right? Because these adenosine levels go down when you sleep. Right. So if you're napping, especially at the wrong times of the day, we're kind of taking those adenosine levels down a little bit.
Yeah.
Where it can be more difficult to initiate restful sleep at night. The next point in regards to naps is the time of day. And this is probably more obvious, but for the same reasons with that sleep pressure, too late in the day and we don't allow enough time for that sleep pressure to kind of build back up. So therefore, like I usually suggest leaving at least, you know, 7 or 8 hours following a nap until bedtime.
Right.
And then the last point with naps, if you're going to be implementing them, is the duration. So there's basically two categorizations that I have to naps. They should either be 20 to 30 minutes, right? And this is the power nap, right? And this is more of a, what we can call like a cognitive reset, where when you get this period of nap, we know that, you know, energy levels increase a little bit, your ability to focus increases. So all of those elements of the mental cognitive performance.
Okay.
And then the other is it should be about 75 to 90 minutes. And the reason is if we're sleeping a nap longer, what we really should be after is trying to attain an entire sleep cycle and all the physiological benefits that come with that, right? And the typical sleep cycle is around 90 minutes. So anything in between those two, and we might, one, miss out on some of the benefits, and we could get yanked out of one of the deeper stages of sleep, and we can experience what everyone's experienced at some point, that sleep inertia, mm-hmm. where you just feel like crap. You feel like you should still be sleeping. And then I guess the last thing with naps would be, if you do nap regularly and it doesn't impact your sleep health at night at all, I definitely would recommend keeping your nap time consistent day to day. Again, that regularity aspect is really important.
Right. Some awesome advice there on naps, for sure. Now, sometimes you come across the hacking, the biohacking and stuff like this, and it was pretty popular not too long ago. I feel like it's starting to drop off a little bit. But one of their go-to things was like, if you haven't got a good night's sleep, you can biohack your way, take a 5 to 10 minute nap, and you're good to go. I was like, what is this based on? Was that actually based on any sort of research, or was that someone just making that up?
I think any period. Well, firstly, I think any period of time that you carve out in the day where you're taking a step away from technology and you're taking a step away from all the things that you're doing mm-hmm. is a recovery. And I think that there's benefit to that. Mm-hmm. I think we all know the feeling of just those days where you just don't stop and you're constantly either entrenched in what you're doing or you're entrenched in your phone or whatever it is. So I think, the idea that those 5 to 10 minutes probably is just even if you're not actually sleeping, is just a step away and it's a reset. And I think that's probably where some of the benefits come from. The idea that there's no research to point to that you're getting any of the sleep benefits, right? Any of those physiological benefits to sleep by only sleeping 5 to 10 minutes. I think it's probably more of that idea that you're just kind of, taking a step back and, even if your eyes are closed and you're not actually sleeping, just the ability for you to detach from the environment, I think, is really powerful.
So. Right. Cool. Now, I mentioned earlier on about like shift work and, there was research not too long ago that stated that people who are working shift work large amounts of time of their life, that inability to have regular sleep patterns could be classified at the same level of, a pretty bad carcinogen, right?
Exactly.
What is your approach there with shift workers?
Yeah, so it was actually from the World Health Organization, and it's actually been upgraded to, unfortunately, they've listed it as, I believe, a probable carcinogen. So not possible, okay. not there's a chance of it. They're listing, especially like you mentioned, long-term shift work. Yeah. And this is not to, instill fear to people who are, working shift, but it's just, unfortunately, it's the reality that we, when you look at shift work, it's being linked to a lot of poor health outcomes. It's being linked to the incidences of a lot of specific cancers, cancer of the bowel, cancer of the breast, cancer of the prostate. So mm-hmm. it is, unfortunately, I never like to instill fear in people with this kind of stuff, but it is the reality. So firstly, if you do have the option to take yourself out of shift work, and this is not the case for everyone, but if you do have that option, it's something you should explore when we're talking playing the long game, right? Long-term health.
Right.
But I know that's not the case for everyone, not feasible if you're, a doctor or a nurse, a first responder, a firefighter, any of these instances where it's just the nature of the job. So first, I think it's important to understand why that's the case. The reason why shift work can actually have these negative health outcomes is that it's very disruptive to that natural circadian rhythm that we talked about. And these natural circadian rhythms are our body's natural 24-hour internal clocks that really are going to possess control over a lot of physiological processes within our body and regulate them, where, for example, blood pressure, body temperature, certain hormones, they rise and fall at a certain time of day based on these circadian rhythms. And when these circadian rhythms are out of whack, a lot of those processes and a lot of those hormones also become out of whack. But ultimately, the body thrives on regularity and rhythm, right? Every cell in the body has these clocks and prefers synchronicity with other cells and with the environment. So we're understanding more and more of how important timing is for our health, not only with respect to sleep, but when we talk about a lot of other variables as well, like nutrition obviously being the big one.
Right.
Part of why intermittent fasting, I think, is so impactful. Obviously, there's a lot of other variables and things that play in, is the idea that you're able to keep your, window of eating and your eating times very consistent. And again, the body really prefers that. So, research continues to point to how even shifting small shifts in these circadian rhythms can affect our health and well-being. So shift work is obviously the ultimate example of this, especially if you're flip-flopping back and forth. Some of the other issues include like the social pressure of trying to be opposite the rest of the world, and the poor cycle that this can fuel. But I think some of the strategies that I use are you have to use what I call your circadian rhythm levers. And these are basically the things you have to use these things to your advantage. And these are the things that can actually influence your circadian rhythm. These are the things that dictate that circadian rhythm. And these are light, temperature, movement, and nutrition and food timing. So you want to try to mimic a rhythm of these things that would be just like anyone else would experience if their day was their night and vice versa, right? So for example, you know, I won't break down each of these, but we'll just use light as the example. What you would want to do is you want to get light during your shift, right? Because much like you or I would be getting light daylight during the day, or hopefully, or some form of it, right. You want to get light during your shift and a lot of it, especially in the first half of your shift. You know, whether it's the last bit of daylight that you get at the end of the day, or, you know, daylight lamps are a great hack for this, even though I don't like the word hack, because the light, the fluorescent lighting that you get in an office building is not going to do it. So you actually make daylight lamps that are where the lux, the measurement of light, is actually very close to that of natural daylight. So instilling a daylight lamp and trying to get as much of that throughout your shift as possible. And then following your shift, you know, you want to think about like what is nighttime for you and me. You want to block as much light as possible following your shift. So, you know, I usually will tell people wear sunglasses on the way home, right? And then when you get home, utilize blackout shades if you don't have them, or a night mask, anything that's going to block out as much light as possible. And then really you're doing those same things for temperature, for movement, for nutrition. You're just trying to create your own circadian rhythm that's just opposite of everyone else. Right. And while you can't completely change and flip-flop that, it does make a pretty tremendous difference.
Yeah. Awesome. Some really good points there. You know, we mentioned a little bit on technology. We want to kind of get into that next. And I just want to get your feedback on not only is it's almost like a requirement now we're around technology all the time, but it's not going away, right? So how can we best manage that? And then once you kind of answer that, I'll come back. I'll have the second part for you too, okay?
Yeah, of course. So firstly, I think, you know, obviously technology is it's most definitely negatively impacting our sleep. I wouldn't discount that in any way, shape, or form. Right. But in my experience, it's the other variables that are more important. And it's some of the foundational stuff that we talked about first. And the reason for that is, you know, you have to establish a good behavioral foundation for your sleep and your sleep health and why sleep is important for you. And that sets forth you ultimately using technology less around the time of sleep. You know, once you truly value sleep as being important and you ingrain the right thought process and have the right habits and routines, technology becomes less of an issue. And this is not to discount and say that technology doesn't matter. Otherwise, you know, you're leaving it to be very reactive, where sometimes you're using it less. You know, the night that you think about it, you're like, I'm going to use my laptop a little bit less. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the other thing with technology is if you absolutely have to be using it, and this is another behavioral aspect, don't use technology in your bed or bedroom. And the reason for this is not just the impact that technology like blue light and all these things can have on us. It's the association that's created. So I get a lot of people that will do work in bed or work in even in their bedroom.
Yeah.
What this does is this makes your bed and your bedroom a trigger and a place for wakefulness as opposed to sleep. You want your bedroom to basically just be this place, the shrine to sleep, where as soon as you get into the bed or the bedroom, you know, it's this automatic cue for, all right, it's time to sleep, right? And your brain is very associative. So I think a big thing that people make a mistake with too with technology is they use it in bed. You know, it's all a give and take. It's all a balance. I don't think there's anything wrong with, especially if it helps you to relax and it's part of your routine, I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, watching a half hour or an hour of TV kind of leading into bed, as long as you take, you know, maybe 20, 30 minute period in between that where you're winding down a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then as long as when you get into the bed and bedroom, you don't have that technology there. So there's not that association. So I think it's just like anything. It's all about balance, right? Yeah. Like you said, that technology isn't going away. We just have to find ways to, you know, better utilize it or better manipulate it.
Right. Yeah. That's a really good point you bring up about, you know, bringing the phones into the bedroom or the laptops, because I can definitely identify with that. And I'll admit, I've been bad about that. You know, recently I've been on the phone before bed and stuff like that. And it's almost where you're so caught up in what you're doing, you forget the pattern you're creating. But then once it's pointed out to you, you're like, okay, that's obviously something I need to get away from, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think the underestimated piece of that is It's not just even the association or just the fact that it's technology. It's mm-hmm. it's the fact that in most cases, these devices are they're anxiety provoking to a certain mm-hmm. extent. So like, it's very difficult to, you know, read emails late and then, you know, wind down. It doesn't allow enough time for that. And, you know, something I always talk about with people is, you know, one of the mechanisms that works against us is obviously the arousal system, right? The sympathetic nervous system. So anything that spikes this, even small amounts, you know, close to bed, is really going to work against you in the opposite direction. So, you know, if you're checking your email or, you know, doing something along those lines, you never know what email may have come in that it's some, you know, big thing that you're going to have to deal with the next day. You know, usually if there's a lot of things that are on your plate and a lot of things that you're thinking about, usually the recommendation that I make for people is to journal or do something like a brain dump. So just take a piece of paper and write, you know, all your worries, all your thoughts, all your to-dos for the following day. And just that, you know, idea that they're down on paper, you know, allows you to be at ease a little bit. You're like, all right, I know they're written down. I know I can deal with them tomorrow. And they're not, you know, racing in your head when you're trying to sleep.
Right, right. Now, the second part of the technology question for me was, what is your point of view on and where do you stand on like stuff like, you know, the Oura Ring or sleep tracking apps and stuff like that?
So firstly, I feel like this is my answer to everything, but this is probably the industry. Yeah. Is it depends.
Yeah.
But firstly, I think sleep trackers have done a tremendous – firstly, they're getting better. They're getting a lot better in terms of their accuracy and how effective they are. You know, every product that comes out and every rendition of the product that comes out is even better and better. The next thing is I think they're really good at bringing a lot of awareness to sleep. It gets more people talking about sleep. It brings awareness to how specific variables can impact your sleep, things like caffeine, when you exercise, different foods that you eat, periods of stress. It really helps you to create context, and I think that's really important. However, you know, wearing my coaching hat, if I'm working with someone who's struggling with sleep and the behavioral aspect is what's driving it, it's the negative thoughts, it's the, you know, the fact that they've lost confidence in their ability to sleep and all of those things, sometimes introducing a sleep tracker is not the right option because it's going to promote more anxiety and more stress, especially when they're not getting the number that they want, right? Or the data that they want. So if you're a coach and you're implementing sleep trackers with your clients, I think you have to understand the person that you're working with. Are they the person who's going to do well with data and get motivated by that data? Or are they the type of person who is going to, you know, have more anxiety and more stress build up around it? And if you're just a, you know, individual looking to improve your sleep, you have to know what type of person you are and know what you're going to do in the face of data. But with respect to the sleep trackers, the Oura Ring is definitely the most accurate that I've come across when you compare to like actual Sleep Lab and, you know, the gold standard.
Yeah.
The Oura Ring is definitely the most accurate. None of them are completely 100% accurate, especially when you talk about like distinguishing between sleep stages and the, you know, the quality of those sleep stages. Really, the only way to be measuring those things is in a sleep lab where we're looking at your brainwaves. But like I said, they've come a long way and they're, you know, it used to just be where they were tracking, it was actigraphy, where they were just tracking your movement.
Yeah.
But now they're obviously looking at other variables. They're looking at respiratory rate. They're looking at heart rate variability. And the more variables that you can actually take into account, the more accurate you can obviously be. But until we're really looking at brain waves, it's going to be very difficult to be 100% accurate.
Right. Now, I used to wake up every morning and put on a heart rate strap and take my heart rate variability, right? And so just getting back to what you said, the fact I knew I was testing myself added to my anxiety of what the score would be. You know what I mean? So it's almost like we're better off not knowing we've been tested if there's some way of doing that. And I guess the Oura Ring is kind of good in that respect because after a while it's just on there and you're not really fully aware of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I think a lot of times for sleep, and we kind of touched on this, is if you're the type who doesn't do well with data and technology and a number that you may or may not be getting, the subjective measurements are a good way to track your progress, right? Looking, you know, track it, just do like a simple 1 to 5 scale or 1 to 10 scale of your mood, your energy levels, your ability to focus. You know, and when you're truly trying to optimize your sleep and you see these things going up, right, you track the amount of caffeine that you have, how long does it take you to fall asleep, you know, any variation of these things, and you're going to have a metric or, you know, a way to look at your progress and your success. You'll know that you're improving. But if you're the type who, like I said, can do well with data and it motivates you, it can be that positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement. And it helps to create a lot of awareness and context where like, all right, what was different last night? All right, I had caffeine too late. I didn't do a wind down routine or whatever it is. It allows you to really pinpoint the areas that you need to improve.
Just one question that came up for me there was in relation to like technology, social media especially. Do you touch on this and what your clients are exposed to? Because like you just mentioned, right, if you're looking at this timeline of upsetting things on social media, Twitter, whatever it is, that's having an effect on your central nervous system, your response, right?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I use the example of an email. And there can certainly be an email that you get that, you know, spikes the sympathetic nervous system and spikes you in a negative way. But the ultimate of this is social media. You know, I think especially, for example, you know, and this is maybe personal, but, you know, when you're alone at night and when it's nighttime and when it's bedtime, I think that's when we do the most self-reflecting. Yeah. And I think most people can probably relate to this. But when we're really, you know, more introspective and when we're looking at these things and how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about how we performed that day. And social media in that instance is the absolute worst thing that you should be looking at because, you know, you like you mentioned, I mean, social media is just basically people highlighting all the good and positive of their life. They're not posting the mundane aspects. They're not posting the, you know, the moments where they may, you know, not feel so great about themselves. They're only posting the highs.
Yeah.
So, you know, a scroll through social media at night when you may not feel as great about yourself is the absolute worst. And again, anything that activates that arousal system, even just a little bit, you know, in that time leading up to bed is the complete opposite of what you want. So, you know, if you have to be on social media, you know, whatever, fine. But take after you're done and take a half hour to do something else, whether it's read or, you know, meditate or breathe or whatever it is, even if it means you go to bed later. Yeah. I would say you're better served in that situation, sleeping a half hour less, but getting the better quality and putting yourself in a better mindset.
Right, right. And something I've mentioned to people I'm around is that like just be aware of what you're exposing yourself to. You know, like be aware of what people you follow or what accounts you follow because that affects you whether you recognize it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're looking at in social media, and I think we're probably going to find out more of this, I think it's very similar to from like a psychological perspective when, you know, and we've all heard this over and over, you know, you're the sum of the people that you spend the most amount of time with, right? Your friends, the people that you spend time with, you become the average of those people because they have that influence over you. And I think we need to be looking at social media in a very similar similar way, right? Are we only following Instagram models and, you know, looking at them in that way and, you know, or are we looking at, you know, whatever it is. I think, like you said, people just need to be more self-aware in terms of, I don't think we know the long-term impact of how that's really influencing, you know, our mental health for
right,
sure.
Right, for sure. Awesome. Nick, listen, this has been absolutely awesome. Definitely worth the wait.
Yeah. I hope so, yeah.
Just go ahead and fill everybody in where they can find you, your website, social media, all that good stuff.
Yeah, sure. So I'm on all the typical social media platforms, Instagram, Facebook, and I'm the online sleep coach on all of them. My website is onlinesleepcoach.com. I'm in the process of putting together, like I mentioned, a lot of educational material and courses and workshops for coaches and practitioners. So you can find information about that at sleepcoachcourse.com. So I'm in the process of putting together a comprehensive course for other coaches, an online course. And then starting this year, I'm doing a lot of in-person workshops, one-day sleep coaching workshops, kind of taking everyone through everything from the anatomy and physiology of sleep to the assessment to the step-by-step coaching process to what you do in special situations to how do you market it and all those things.
Awesome. Well, I will I'll include a link in the show notes to that for you, and we'll get that set up. But listen, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks a lot for having me on. Glad we were finally able to connect.
I know. Guys listening at home, check out Nick's website. Lots of good content on the social media. Also, great tips on there every day. And we will catch you guys on the next episode of Pillars of Health.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Pillars of Health podcast. If you found the information helpful and you enjoyed the show, head over to iTunes and leave us a review and help us spread the word.